Welcome to the Tailored Life Podcast, the one and only fitness and nutrition podcast that goes way beyond just training and nutrition and helps you create a life by design. I'm your host, Cody McBroom, and today I have the godfather of muscle and fitness, of bodybuilding, of strength training, of content creation. This is a legend in the space. I'm very excited to have him on the show. Not only is he a wealth of knowledge, he's also a wealth of experience in the industry, and he has a wealth of experience with content creation. And I say that because he was publishing articles as magazines were becoming the mainstay way to get information in the fitness space, and he continued to adapt, evolve, and transition into the different platforms, websites, articles, forums, all the different things, and he's stayed relevant throughout the whole process. He owns a supplement company. He owns a website, an app. He is known for his programming, for his science, for the studies he's put in the field. The guy I am talking to today is Dr. Jim Stepani, and I'm very excited to bring him on because he has his PhD in exercise physiology from the University of Connecticut. So he has gone into a lot of different research studies, some of which we talked about today with different things regarding protein, intermittent fasting, so on and so forth. But he's also got more experience than most people who are researchers. He has so much experience with training celebrities, training everyday folks, writing programs for millions of people online. Again, writing programs and articles that get read by millions of people every month. He has had so much experience, so much time in the game. This is a really, really cool podcast to sit in on and just listen to the conversation between myself and him and just really, really pull away so many nuggets, especially if you're a coach, but even if you're just a training enthusiast and somebody who wants to constantly evolve and learn and grow, this podcast is going to serve you so well. So I'm going to link his website, his social medias, all that kind of stuff in the description. Make sure you give him a follow, check out his site, head over to Instagram, post a story of this on your Instagram story and tag us both because we want to thank you for listening. We want to share it on our story. And yeah, without any further ado, let's talk to the fitness godfather, Dr. Jim Stepani. Yeah, you know, I was going to say you were probably the original tattooed fitness guy, most well, you know,
maybe, right?
You know,
yes, I go back quite a ways.
I started getting tattooed pretty early as well. I'm 31. I got into the industry at 18, and I started getting tattooed at 17. So I've been
right. Yeah, I'm right around there as well. So
I've
yeah,
been loving them. So, well, man, I'm excited to do this. This is we're going to talk about you today, but just, I want to give you a backstory because this is really cool for me to have you on the show because I've been following you for, man, I don't know how long. I mean, before I could actually follow you because social media wasn't around. And
yeah, exactly. Right. You had to pick up a magazine or a book, right?
Yeah.
You had to get the print.
Yep. And then forums.
Isn't that crazy to think about?
Like, it is.
When I talk about some of my past experiences, like Muscle and Fitness Magazine, bodybuilding.com, people like in their 20s just stare at me with a blank face. And I'm like, oh, right. This is not relevant to you at all.
Yeah. I started my internship while I was going to school, and I was working at a grocery pharmacy kind of thing. And that's really what I did to pass the time. I read Muscle and Fitness magazines and Flex magazines, stuff like that. So I it's cool. There's been a couple times where I've had somebody on the podcast where Steve Kluko, I've been able to connect with. I had him on long ago.
Great guy.
And it was the same thing. It's like, just like you, I'm like, man, I remember reading a magazine where you were on the cover. And yep, it's really cool for me. So I'm excited to have you on. I'm excited to dive into stuff. And
thank you. I appreciate the longtime support.
Yeah, absolutely.
Acknowledge it.
Why don't we start with, for anybody who maybe hasn't been in the game long enough to read magazines and blogs and forums and such, so many people know who you are, but I'd love for you to just kind of give a synopsis, your little intro in a nutshell. Who is Jim Stepani?
How do you hone it down? I have a PhD in exercise physiology with a minor in biochemistry from the University of Connecticut. My master's was in basically focusing on sports nutrition with my master's thesis was on medium chain triglycerides. This is back around 1991, before anybody really knew what coconut oil was. you know, those of us who were interested in bodybuilding knew that these shorter chain fatty acids had something. So that was my master's thesis. And then I went on and did my postdoctoral fellowship at Yale School of Medicine in the Department of Cellular Molecular Physiology, where I was studying how exercise and nutrition influence gene regulation, turning on and off certain genes. So, you know, I'm a big proponent of, you know, the cellular level, understanding what happens there, and then trying to apply it. But, you know, I was an award-winning scientist at Yale School of Medicine, but I was taking what I was doing in the lab and writing, you know, layperson articles and literally just basically cold calling or cold emailing, if you will, Muscle and Fitness, sent over my articles. It happened to get to the right person. Eventually got to Joe Weider. He read them, loved the concept that I was doing, taking what I was doing in the lab and applying it. And I started writing for them while I was at Yale. And then eventually they asked me, Muscle and Fitness and Flex Magazine, this is the Weider publications. For those of you who don't know Joe Weider, but most of us wouldn't even be here without Joe Weider and his influence.
Yeah.
They asked me to come out to be their science editor at Muscle and Fitness. And so I came out for an interview. I love the concept because I was in the lab working on specific genes, like one called AMP kinase, which is just a metabolic gene, not to bore anybody with that. But you know, to get funding, you've got to be really up on that area. And you know, as a scientist, you're really focused on this one area. And, you know, I'd be on PubMed, for those of you who understand what that is. You go to look for studies, and I'd see new creatine study. I'm like, I don't have time to read that. You know, I've got to get onto this aim. And all this, you know, research that I was interested in was passing me by that I didn't really have time to really focus on. And I saw this opportunity as a science editor for these bodybuilding fitness magazines as a way to bridge that gap between what was going on in the science, you know, and how to apply that in the gym and the kitchen, because nobody was doing that. You know, all my colleagues would do a study, let's say it's on broccoli, and they found a reduced risk of cancer with broccoli. And then you ask them, so should people eat more broccoli? Oh, we're not saying that. We're just saying that there is a correlation between those who eat more broccoli and the risk of cancer. So, you know, that's all we're saying. You know, nobody was really telling the public, what does this research mean? Is there anything that we can take from this in applying the real world? And so I really saw that as my opportunity to bridge that gap. And so when I took the position and told all my colleagues at Yale School of Medicine that I was going to work for Muscle and Fitness magazine, they literally sat me down and wanted to do an intervention because they thought I was throwing my career away. Here I am, this award-winning scientist. You know, you've got a career in academia going and in research, you know, NIH and all the funding. Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, no, what you guys don't understand is the reason that I got into science was I was reading Muscle and Fitness as a 13-year-old kid. In fact, I could remember going to Myrtle Beach on vacation and my dad would buy me the muscle magazines. That's how I got into weightlifting, was my dad. And I was lying on the floor in this condo that we had rented, and everybody's out at the pool. I'm lying on the floor reading about muscle fiber type at 13 and going, wow, there's people studying how muscle grows and contracts and how you get, I'm like, you know, this is what I want to do. As a kid, I carried a doctor bag everywhere I went. As you know, a little kid, that was my thing. I wanted to be a doctor. But here I was like, MD, no, I want to be a research scientist. I want to learn how muscles get bigger, get stronger. And so when I left Yale, I'm like, trust me, guys, I understand you think I've lost my marbles, but I'm going back. This is full circle. This is how I got into science. Now I'm sort of bringing back my scientific knowledge into the application of fitness and bodybuilding, and the rest is sort of history from the magazines, you know. And again, for those of you who don't understand the magazines and the history here, the Muscle and Fitness magazines were read by over 40 million people worldwide. These were published all over the world, and that was the number one fitness magazine, Muscle and Fitness, in the time, and that was the way that people got their information. There was no social media. There was no, there wasn't even a YouTube yet, you know, really, to be honest with you at this time, or at least it really wasn't a thing quite yet. You know what I mean? It was starting to blossom, and then Facebook came along, but it was all print back then. And that was the main way people read. So literally almost every person who was interested in fitness knew who I was, because almost everybody somehow picked up that fitness magazine, and that built a huge, huge following. And then bodybuilding.com reached out to me. Now we're talking about going into, you know, I left Yale in 2002, got to Muscle and Fitness in LA. But then bodybuilding.com started blossoming around 2005, six. And that's when they asked me if I would start doing content for them for free. Completely free. And you know, with Muscle and Fitness understanding that we were going to connect, you know, what they were doing digitally and bring it back to us and on our line, on our musclefitness.com website. But this was at a time when nobody really understood what online information was. And in fact, I was started doing musclefitness.com videos on how to train, because as an educator, how would you educate somebody with a, you know, the way I compare it to is trying to teach somebody how to tie their shoe. Would you rather do it with words and still photos, or a video on how to loop and, you know, what's easier? So I saw, once the internet and the YouTube was there, I'm like, this is amazing. I can teach somebody how to bench press, you know, curl, you know, without having to write it all out, you know, the minutiae of doing a curl, bringing your shoulders back. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. I can show them in a video. And so I really took to that as a great educational tool. But most of the higher ups at the executive level didn't understand what I was doing. They thought I was cannibalizing the magazines, because everything online is free. So who's going to pay to read the magazines and get the workouts if you're giving it away for free, Jim? That's idiotic. So, so I eventually left Muscle and Fitness, because it was an antiquated way to educate people, and they weren't willing to sort of bridge, you know, move forward with, you know, what the future of education and media actually is. And so I started working with bodybuilding.com, and again, not getting paid. The Shortcut to Size program that literally millions of people have done at bodybuilding.com was a free program, which is why it was so popular, I mean, let alone that it was effective. And so that sort of built a following. And then, you know, I was writing, this is back, you know, really before sort of pre-workout was a thing, you know, teaching people, look, for a pre-workout, you put in creatine, beta-alanine, betaine, branch chains, maybe some taurine, right? These are the ingredients that are going to help you. These are nutrients that can actually help your performance and your results after. But then what happened with the pre-workout category was it became all about stimulants. And if you remember going back to like 2010 or so, most of the pre-workouts were like a 3 to 5 gram scoop, you know? And what was worse was that they were lying to people saying, well, it's concentrated. I'm like, no, a gram of leucine is a gram of leucine, okay? You're putting in 500 milligrams of leucine. It is not the same as 5 grams of leucine, no matter what magic you claim. And so I really was fed up with the industry as a whole. The fact that company after company was just willing to lie, this is super concentrated. And it's just like, that's a complete fallacy. You're lying to the consumer, and you're ruining what supplements, you know, actually do. If it wasn't for supplements, we wouldn't have aspirin, right? Aspirin started as a extract from bark and willow tree, right? So, you know, the way we know about medicine is they were first supplements, right? They were taken from plants and concentrated down and used. And so it was ruining, you know, what we know about supplements, because they were putting almost nothing in there. It was pixie dust. So of course people lost hope with the benefits of what branched chain amino acids can do for you, or creatine or beta alanine, because they weren't getting any. So of course they weren't experiencing what you should be experiencing if you're getting a proper dose, right, of creatine and beta alanine. And so I was teaching people how to make their own. And what they started doing was asking me to come up with my own supplement line. I'm not a scientist I am a scientist. I am not a businessman. So I have never had any intention of starting my own supplement company. You know, I started the fitness website, jimstepani.com, with the app as a way to get people, you know, the workouts that I was doing, so you can take them to the gym and whatnot. But supplements, I'm like, look, I'm teaching you guys how to make them on your own. Here you go. You know, but it doesn't taste good. You know, you're mixing in different raw ingredients. And so, you know, I finally decided, yeah, let's do this. And we'll take the formulas that I've been teaching them how to make and just put them into a bottle, and then you've got it in one scoop. You don't have to mix, you know, six or seven different ingredients or more, and it tastes a lot better. And so that's when we launched Gym Supplement Science. That was about 2013.
I think one thing I want to point out that, you know, you mentioned you're not a business guy, and that might have worked to your advantage a little bit. And this is probably why some of the folks at Weider maybe didn't understand this, but one thing I've appreciated about your story right there, just watching, is your ability to adapt with the industry. And, you know, going from magazine to YouTube, fitness, membership sites, bodybuilding.com, for some people, that's a hard shift to make, you know, and it's cool to see, because I think it was Henry Ford that talked about, you know, if I gave them what they want, they would ask for faster horses, right? This is a quote from him. Right. And he knew that the times were changing, things had to adapt. And so You've done that well. And I see a lot of people complain about this today with even social media. Oh, the algorithm. Oh, there's TikTok. And right. It's kind right. of like, yes. You know, you're either creating value or you're not. And then as times change, you have to adapt how you're delivering that value no matter what. So just your thoughts, yeah, your advice to people, you know, on that, you know?
That is a great point. And that's one of the things that I say that most brands mistakes, like Muscle and Fitness, they're still around, but how relevant are they today? You know, I mean, yeah. From when you knew them, right? Even bodybuilding.com. Do you remember the bodybuilding.com heydays? That's where everybody went online, the forums, get information, how to take creatine, mm-hmm. and when to order creatine. There you go, right? They're almost dead as well. And the problem is they see themselves, Muscle and Fitness saw themselves as a magazine. Bodybuilding.com saw themselves as a website. You can't see yourself as a certain type of media. You have to be fitness media and change with the way that people change how they consume media. And like you said, you know, with all the influencers now and the different social media platforms, for someone like me, it's mind-boggling that this changed so fast. Like you said, you've been following me for a long time. How many went back then, going back like 20 years ago, even wow, it's been over 20 years. Just want to stop right there. Wow. but, you know, going back 20 years ago, how many of us were doing that? There was a handful of us. You know what I mean? Yeah. I can think of Lane Norton, a couple other names that come to mind that were putting out videos and trying to teach people how to eat, how to lift. Now there's hundreds of thousands, if not millions, right, of fitfluencers, mm-hmm. If you will. So it is just mind-boggling for me to see how this has changed. But again, like you said, it's a, you know, you adopt it and you adapt. Right. And so, you know, sure, I can complain all day about the stupid algorithm and whatnot, or I could make quicker videos. You know what I mean? I could put the punchline right up front in the video that's going to grab, you know what I mean? There's, you know, little things that we need to do. And that's no different than when we had the magazines. When we had the magazines, right, that would be in the newsstand, right? So the newsstand was your 5 seconds to grab them. So on that cover, the cover of the magazine, you had to have all those, you know, grow an inch on your arms, get abs now. You know what I mean? Like those are all the grab. It's the same thing that we do now on TikTok and Instagram, you know, get them quick, immediately let them know what the video is. Again, there's no more, hi, I'm Dr. Jim Stepani. And if you like taking creatine, you know, it's like, you know, you got to get right to the point. You know what I mean? Should you take creatine every day? And then get into it. And so it's just adapting and learning. And like as I said, as frustrating as it is, it's also fun because I love a challenge, right? I mean, that's why most of us are into fitness. We love to challenge ourselves. And so it's just another way to challenge what I do. you know, on the daily, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, marketing hasn't changed, right? It's the same thing, just in different
right. Mediums. Like I said, the cover of the magazine is the same, you know, yeah. You got to get to the point quick. What are you trying to teach them?
Yeah. It's such a good point. I think that, and it's funny you mentioned Lane Norton, but you know, there's, and I mentioned Steve earlier. And so like, there's going to be common people that we both think of, but there's certain people who have adapted over time. But I think the main thing that sticks with coaches, companies, content creators, the only way they last is if the value is good. You know, if you're actually teaching people educational material that is authentic. Not, you can think of a catchy hook to get somebody sucked in, but if you're just a influencer and you don't have any real value, it's not going to last. So my question for you on this would be just advice for, you know, there's a lot of coaches that listen to this podcast. What is your advice to them to continue learning, continue growing, continue delivering evidence-based material? Because obviously, I mean, you know this better than anybody. Science keeps evolving. New studies keep coming out.
Yes.
There's always principles, and we're going to get into that soon, because I'm going to ask you some of your fundamental principles. But what is your way of staying up to date on the research and being able to continually evolve what you're teaching? Or do you just teach the same thing in a million ways because there really is, it boils down to certain things, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's really both. It's doing, you know, it's obviously being open-minded, I think, is the most critical thing. For example, I and every scientist in 2000 would tell you not to have casein protein around workouts because it's too slow. You want to have whey protein, right? Because it's quick, it's fast, it gets digested quickly, it goes right to the muscle, right? And then Robert Wolf's lab in Galveston, Texas, which did a lot of the protein synthesis studies, showed that when you combine whey with casein, the casein wasn't, it was, sure, it's slower digested, but you still get the same response from the casein. So, and in fact, if you take both whey and casein, now you've got a quick boost from the whey, and then the casein stays in the bloodstream longer. So now muscle protein synthesis rate stays up longer, right? Whereas if you just took whey, it'd spike and then drop, because now all those amino acids are leaving your bloodstream, right? With the casein, it's going to last longer. So that's just one example of the information that has changed. But you, a lot of people, I think, see the change and don't want to admit it and think that they're admitting that they're wrong. Mm. And you know what I mean? Like, you, yeah. For example, and again, this isn't, it's not that anybody was lying, but it's just, this is the information that we had at the time. But if you get, a person gets caught lying, they really like double down. And now it's like, even though they know they're wrong, they know they've been caught, they're going to be like, no, I was right. That's not what happened. You know, they double down, and that's the biggest mistake you could make with science, because it's sure you're wrong, but you weren't wrong at the time. That's what the entire world believed. And that's, you know, with scientists coming together, that's where we all sort of landed, was the casein is too slow, whey is fast. And unfortunately that belief still exists today. People are like, oh, you need whey protein. You have to have whey. It's only whey. You got to have whey. And it's like, well, yeah, you want that fast whey, but you also want slower, different protein sources for the digestion rate, for the amino acid differences that are in there. You know, it's really more about having a blend. But you see that so often, people just like double down, like, this is the only, you know, this is the only way to train. And it's like, there's not one way to train. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like, sure, I get that that's your thing, that's your program that you do. But sure, that's a great program. But, you know, one of the problems with resistance training research is you can't really compare pre-exhaust to straight sets. You can, but it really depends where that person is in their training, right? If they've been doing straight sets for 3 years, probably switching to pre-exhaust for 6 to 8 weeks is probably going to do them some good, right? Mm-hmm. Or if they were doing pre-exhaust for the last 8 weeks, probably switching to just straight sets, regular, you know, using your multi-joint movements first in the workouts, going to more, you know, single joint movements towards the end, switching back to that would probably be a benefit for that person. So when you pull all these people into a science study and you're comparing this program versus this program, it's not really a fair comparison. It doesn't work that way because everybody's an individual and it depends on where they are in their training. So, you know, one of my models is everything works, nothing works forever, which is why you need to constantly change. Sure, there's certain fundamentals that we can hold on to. If you're a bodybuilder, don't go in the gym and do 2 to 5 reps for, you know, every set. That's probably not going to maximize muscle growth in the long run. But again, it's more about change in changing your program, you know, over time, what you're doing, you know, even like rest periods. And we know now that, you know, volume is important to change, et cetera. So, you know, I think I've kind of gone off on a rant here that's gone off topic, but, you know, getting back to your question, I think it's really being open-minded about moving forward with, you know, what works, whether it's nutrition, supplements, or training.
Yeah. You know, I think that's why a lot of great scientists usually start with, as of now, we know that, you know, and it's because they know it's gonna, right. It could change. And a good example of what you're saying, and I want to highlight this because I think it's important for people to understand, you know, research is amazing. We need it. But what's done in practice can differ. You know, I think that's the beauty about being evidence-based. It's combining the two.
For sure.
So, you know, the pre-exhaust is a good example. If somebody doesn't have good awareness or mind muscle connection, can't really target a muscle well, maybe this helps them, you know, make something right. more quad yes. dominant. You do some leg extensions first,
yep.
but then you get so strong that now it's limiting your volume, right? But then at a certain point yes. you get so strong that your volume's too high. You're going to have low back issues, or you're going to be in the gym squatting for 2 hours straight to get enough of a workout for hypertrophy. So now you go back, you know, same thing with yes. volume, yes. right? You need yep. volume to grow, but at first anything works. Then you get to intermediate and it's like, okay, now you need a lot of volume, but then you get strong enough and you have a good connection and the skill of firing a muscle, you should probably lower that volume because you're going too heavy and you got to factor in that the load, you know? So
yeah, it's, yes. it's yeah, just never exactly. black and just like, you know, a lot of bodybuilders will do, you know, like drop sets and rest pause and forced reps and negatives. And then you tell them, you know, have you tried just doing, you know, 3 sets of 8 to 10 for a while? And they're like, well, you know, that would be too low intensity. I wouldn't get any results. And when they do that, they actually start seeing results.
Yeah.
Because again, you know, you could only train at your, you know, peak performance for only so long. Right. And then you know what I mean? And you're eventually pushing yourself that hard and that far is not going to lead to results, and now you literally have to back off on the intensity and like you said, maybe even the volume to start seeing some of those results.
Yeah,
you know, so it's really, it depends on the person and where they are in their training.
Yeah, 100%. I'm huge on this, is why I called the company Tailored Coaching Method because of this, but
yes, love it.
I'm curious, you know, this is, I know, like most things we're talking about, it's kind of a, it depends, and then a long-winded answer afterwards. But
right.
people always want to know. So what is your recommendations on like how long a training block should be, or when do you create, you know, when do you change up the exercises you're doing? Because, you know, if we look at strength literature, especially with like sport and Olympic lifting and stuff, it's very clear cut. Periodization is a certain way it works. We can follow that.
Yep.
There's been a lot of research on hypertrophy and showing that periodization doesn't really matter much. It's more of programming. And so now it's kind of like, well, if periodization doesn't really matter, it changes the game because it could depend on so many different factors. But the average person reaching out to you and asking you, like, when do I change up my exercise? How long should I follow a program before I switch things up? What is your typical answer for that?
Yeah, so like you said, you know, it depends, right? It's first thing is the goal. So what is their goal? Are they a power lifter? So then obviously you've got a bench press, you've got a squat, you've got a deadlift, right? There's no replacing
Yeah.
Not doing it, you know, you have to involve those three exercises in some capacity, whether you're having a dynamic day, a heavy day, you know, like you have to work those into your program. And if you don't, we know with the principle of specificity, right? You're sure you doing dumbbell bench press will help carry over some strength on the barbell bench press. But if you're a power lifter, you better be barbell bench pressing if you want to continue. And yeah, except for, you know, if you're detraining or, you know, in right. certain periods. But when, you know, you're 12 weeks, 16 weeks out from a powerlifting competition, you're bench pressing, you're squatting, you're doing deadlifts, right? You're not changing up the exercise going, you know what, we'll just do Romanian deadlifts today for deadlifts. You know, you need that specificity and you're changing up, you know, whether it's dynamic, whether you're going super heavy, whether you're 5x5s, right? So it really depends on the goal. If the goal is strength, right? Is it strength specific? Are they a power lifter? They have to move, or is it just overall, like a, you know, you want a football player to have more power, you know, in a certain amount of strength, then maybe we can play around with some of the exercises. But typically when we talk about strength, sure, there's some carryover from, you know, a dumbbell bench press to a bench press, but to really maximize your bench press strength, you need to bench press, mm-hmm. right? And then when we get to hypertrophy, it's a whole different ball game now, right? With strength, we know doing some form of periodization, right? Whether it's linear, reverse linear, undulating, pendulum, as long as you're periodizing in some form, your strength gains will be optimized versus just sticking with 3 to 5 reps, right? But with bodybuilding, or it's muscle growth, hypertrophy, right? It's a whole different game and it's a whole different strategy. As you said, periodization isn't quite as critical, but what I find is change is. So, you know, periodization sort of is important in the fact that you're periodizing some form of change, right?
Yeah.
Whether you're working in the 8 to 10 rep range, or you're going up to 20 to 25 reps, or you're down in the 5 to 6 rep range. Are you resting 3 minutes between sets? Are you only resting 1 minute? What is your, you know, so with hypertrophy, it's more about, instead of, and again, periodization will definitely, I believe, will produce hypertrophy. Is it absolutely critical? No. You can take somebody and put them in the 8 to 12 rep range and compare that to a periodized plan. Let's say it's 8 weeks. You might see similar gains in muscle size in both of those, right? But over time, that 8 to 12 rep range, they're going to start stagnating. Whereas the periodized group, I think if they're continuing that over longer period, will continue to make better gains than if they were just sticking with that one rep range. So again, while periodization isn't as critical for hypertrophy as it is for strength, I do think it works, right? So we know periodization works. But I think for hypertrophy, it's more about change. And like you were saying, how often do you change the program? I typically say 6 to 8 weeks, unless that program, if we're talking about it's, you know, eight, they come in and do 8 to 12 reps, they do a drop set in the last one, last set, yada, yada, then I would stick with that for no longer than maybe 8 weeks. If it's something where, like, something where you're doing microcycles, where week one is 15 to 20 reps, week two is 10 to 12, week three, then you could probably carry that program out much further if your goal is hypertrophy. You know, that you could go 12 weeks, maybe even 24 weeks, because you're constantly, the change is built into the program, right? So it really depends on the program. If you're just sticking with sort of a similar program that doesn't change week to week, then I would say every 6 to 8 weeks, you'd want to change up your programming, right? Whether it's your reps, your rest periods, et cetera. But then the exercise question is a whole different question, right? Because it's like, you know, what are you focusing on? If it's a bodybuilder who needs to bring up their upper chest, right? So they're focusing on, you know, incline presses and incline flies and that sort of thing to target more of the upper pecs. should they change that if that's their goal? You know what I mean? To exercises that wouldn't really hit the upper pec area is hard. Or they're trying to bring out, you know, more delt width with the middle delt. So that's a great question, and a little more, I guess, confusing to answer, because it's like getting back to the thing, it really depends.
Yeah.
But, you know, it depends on what that person's goal is. Could you change up exercises every 6 to 8 weeks? Sure. But what you may find is certain exercises help to hit those areas that you're trying to develop more than others. And in that case, you should probably stick with some of those. But anyway, I hope that wasn't too confusing.
Well, I think that's the point. You know, when people ask that question, you can't answer it without all the nuance. And right. So it's good that you did. And I do think that ultimately it comes down to, don't change things just to change things. Like, have a reason for it. So if you do need to change that exercise, why? Is it bugging you? Is you not have the right equipment? Like,
Or have you been doing it for a year straight? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. And as you were, so we have a chief science officer on our staff. He's a researcher as well. And we did a podcast. We'll do research reviews every now and then. And we did one on the research with periodization and programming for hypertrophy, because a study came out and that they were the kind of ones that alluded to, it doesn't really matter for hypertrophy, because most mm-hmm. research before was all done on strength. And sometimes they would pull hypertrophy results from strength focus. Yeah. And as you were talking, I kind of started thinking, you know what? Like, it's still a point of, okay, now we're looking for the result of hypertrophy. But the way periodization has been built was because strength coaches, usually in sport, were programming a certain way for their clients, and that's just what worked, and that's what they did. And then eventually scientists took it into the lab, and that's what we know. And so my opinion, you know, even your answer with changing things up for hypertrophy, that's because you're actually somebody who, you know, is in the practice as well, not just a researcher. So you have a lot of experience, and you can lean on that experience of what really works, you know. So it's probably only a matter of time before they come out with better research on hypertrophy with hypertrophy-based periodization from guys who are actually doing it like us, and we might find something else. It might matter a whole lot.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly, yeah.
I think research in general just takes so long for it to come out, which is actually, this is a great way to kind of segue into this question. And it's just that with so much experience personally, what do you feel like have been the biggest changes or shifts that you've seen in the industry outside of, you know, magazine to social media and that kind of stuff, but like more so along the lines of what's actually practiced in the gym by bodybuilders and people dieting to lose fat and stuff like that? Is there any really big things that have shifted, or maybe your, you know, paradigm shattering things as far as like,
what intermittent fasting. For one, you would never think intermittent fasting and fitness would go together, right?
Yeah.
20 years ago, anybody who told you, oh, you should consider fasting, would be like, that's the stupidest thing. Your metabolism will stall and you're going to lose all your muscle mass. And it's just like, okay. And again, I wasn't the biggest proponent of intermittent fasting when it first sort of came out. And I did research at Yale on intermittent fasting. We looked at what happens when you feed a high protein meal after your intermittent fast or a high carb meal. And I won't bore you guys with the results, but the high protein meal helped to. So what happens with intermittent fasting is it basically pokes holes in your mitochondria. It creates these uncoupling proteins, which is one of the genes that I studied at Yale. And so when you fast, you poke these holes, and so now you're burning all these substrate, right? Carbohydrates and fat, but you're not getting the same amount of ATP. You're creating more heat. And so you burn more. Okay. So what I don't like about intermittent fasting is you have these 16-hour periods or even 24-hour periods where you're not eating. We know muscle breakdown is ramping up during that period, right? And so I never really liked recommending that for anybody who was in the fitness, because why lose muscle during that fast? But we know that intermittent fasting comes along with a whole host of health benefits, not just the fat loss, right? A whole host of health benefits. And so now I recommend intermittent fasting for those who want to maximize their health and their fat loss. But for muscle growth, no. You know, you hear about the anabolic diet, eat once a day, and it's like, or you hear about, well, if you fast and then train fasted and then eat a meal, your muscle protein synthesis spike goes even higher than if you ate before the meal. I'm like, well, yeah, that's because muscle protein breakdown went all the way down here. Mm-hmm. And now just to get back to equal, it has to shoot way up here just to get back to where you were to make up for all that muscle protein breakdown. So I recommend intermittent fasting with a caveat. If your goal is to maximize muscle growth, don't do it. If your goal is to maximize your health and your fat loss, then you can consider it. So that's sort of one of the things. We've talked about the casein issue. And then I'd say, let's talk about the debate of the anabolic window. And so, and this gets back to study flaws and subject flaws. And so when, you know, people are saying, oh, the post-workout window has been debunked, there's no such thing, you've got 24 hours to eat your protein and it's gonna be the same. Well, that was in newbies, the 24 hours. When they trained them for 8 weeks, that same lab then found that that 24-hour window dropped down to something around 8 hours. Mm. So my question is, if going from a newbie to somebody who's trained for 8 weeks takes your post-anabolic window down from 24 hours to 8 hours, what does training for 8 years do to the anabolic window? And so I say, I would still focus on getting something to eat post-workout, protein and carbohydrates, obvious for obvious reasons, spike muscle protein synthesis, replenish the muscle and liver glycogen that you lost, and you feel better when you eat. You know what I mean? You go through an intense workout, you feel like crap. Why would you suggest prolonging that person's recovery, if you will, right? Whatever we want to talk about recovery, but just consuming calories in substrates that are going to help them, like I said, recover, just get over that workout and feel better. So,
because
you know that's a thing that's shifted, but I don't agree with the shift on that one. I still think eating closer to your post-workout window, and especially if you're somebody who likes carbs but you're carb sensitive, or you're trying to lose fat and you find that when you drop your carbs a bit it helps post-workout, those carbohydrates that you're consuming are not going to be, at least there's a very limited possibility that we convert into fat. The very likelihood is that they're going to get stored as glycogen, and that's why you're consuming carbohydrates post-workout.
I want to ask an intermittent fasting question because you did some research there, but I do want to ask you this and point this out because we're talking on this topic. And I think that a lot of times, so one question would be how often, you know, do studies use newbies? And this is probably the case because I think a lot of times people look at research and they grab on to the abstract and they just rule out any possibility that it's wrong because it's science and that's a flaw.
Yes, you know? Exactly. They put it on this ivory, up on this pedestal.
Well, and you think about way back, there's the strength rep range, the hypertrophy rep range, and the endurance rep range. And then a study comes out and it's like, you can build muscle in any rep range, so none of it matters. And then you go,
Yes.
Well, yeah, but if I'm doing just sets of 3 to 5 to build muscle, I'm gonna be at the gym all day. My back's gonna hurt. My nervous system's gonna be just taxed. So, even if
I'm 56, so my joints are I'm going to be dying, you know?
Yeah. If you can do that, doesn't necessarily mean you should, you know? But to my point,
exactly.
How often do studies use?
It's kind of boring doing the same thing, you know?
Like, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, one of the things with program design that I found working with so many people is it's important to give them something to look forward to.
Yeah.
You know, so the change that you work in is not just important for the progress that they're making, but it's also important for just the mentality of doing the program. Yeah. Anyway.
And the motivation to train, right? You need that.
Yes.
How often do these studies use newbies or people that are, I use this example with like when a lot of like refeed and diet break studies started coming out and they're like, it's all psychological. And sometimes I would have a problem with that because I'm like, hey, I'm working with some like high performance CrossFitters or physique athletes who also have kids and run a business and they're stressed. And I find a lot of success using these refeeds and these diet breaks for more than just psychological matters, especially when your study is filled with college students who don't have any responsibility or stress, you know? How often is that the case?
So I think lately there's less newbies being used. It happens often, like I said, with the post-workout window. One, however, they, like I said, they then did a second study where they continued training them for 8 weeks to see what had happened with the anabolic window. But more often you get, we had weight trained males aged 22 to 26. And you're like, so you had a bunch of dudes who needed beer money and they said, oh yeah, I work out all the time. And what their workout is, hey Bob, do you want to go to the gym tonight and work out? Sure. And they go to the gym and that's their one workout for the week. Maybe they go back next week for, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, you know, those trained subjects that you see typically aren't what we would consider a trained subject.
Yeah.
You know, to, you know, the type of person who's doing most of my programs, although I work with a lot of beginners and whatnot, but mainly most of the stuff that I'm doing is for somebody in the intermediate to a little more advanced, you know, level. So their training experience is far different than the trained subjects in the study. You know, it's typically, not all cases, but typically it's college age males who, like I said, aren't, you know, hardcore weightlifters, bodybuilders, or CrossFitters, but they're recreational trained, as they say in the study. And, you know, we know what that subject pool looks like as a research scientist. So a lot of times it's really hard to apply what we've learned from that subgroup into the people that, you know, we sort of talk to.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, it goes back to our point of the science is very important, but if you're not putting it into practice or just looking at the principles of it, you don't need, it's using the diet break studies as an example. If it was a 2 week deficit with a 1 week diet break, it doesn't necessarily mean you need to do 14 days, seven days, 14.
Right.
Just
exactly.
Take some time off the diet. Like that's the point. And this is why. So
thank you. Yes.
Take the points out of it.
Yes. Take the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Instead of this, the nuances, but and again, with the studies, like we said, even if they were a perfectly trained group, people who've been training for 10 years, and then you compared two different programs, like I said, it's still not a fair representation of each of those programs because where is that person in their training? Like I said before, you know, if you took somebody who's doing, you know, five sets per muscle group and then tested them on a program that did 20 sets, then maybe that increased volume would create some results. Maybe it's too much for them. Who knows, but it's really important to know where that person is in their training because typically adjusting your training is going to, you know, if you've been training one way for a while, right, changing that up is going to help you make some progress and stop some of the stagnation that may be coming from training the same way for too long. So even with trained subjects, it's really not fair to say, oh, this program works better than this program because this study showed.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah and no, you know what I mean? It's like, where are you in your training? Like both of those programs can work depending on where you're fitting it in in your training.
Well, and it's so true. It's, there's a few studies that, I've like, they're doing this more and I really like it. This doesn't apply to the program, but well, they're look at a measure of hypertrophy and they train the same person, but each leg differently. And it's like, cool. We rule out a lot there. Or Chris Barakat and of course, Brad Schoenfeld, I believe, we're doing a study. I don't know if it came out or not, but I was talking to him about it where it was a volume study, but they take what a person is doing. They document what they've been doing for a while. And then they make a percentage increase of volume versus there just saying everybody's doing 20 sets in this group and 40 in this. And it's, you know, so stuff like that is always, that's so helpful.
Important. And, that, and same with protein, you know, when we look at protein intake, you know, there's, you know, studies that show, 1 gram per pound of body weight is more effective than 0.4. And there's studies showing that 1.5 might even be more, But, and then there's studies that show it doesn't matter. No, the higher protein didn't do anything. And there was a study that came out that is called, the protein, completely blank. It's like the protein gap. Like, so the difference has to be the difference between whether they were using their baseline protein and then putting them on a high protein diet, or you had a low and a high protein. It was the difference in that protein spread. That's the protein spread had to be big enough for you to see a benefit from the higher protein.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so knowing where they were is very important versus just going, oh, this group is eating high protein, this group is eating low protein. What is the difference? You know, you can't really look at it that. And then the other issue with protein and high protein intake is your enzyme levels. If you're eating 1.5 grams per pound of body weight and you were only eating 0.75 and you suddenly jumped up to 1.5, you'll probably see some gains for a while. Then 6 to 8 weeks down the road, that high protein no longer is going to build you any more muscle. And it's due to the fact that our protein efficiency drops because we're consuming so much protein. Our body knows that, look, we're getting plenty of protein. We don't really need to utilize it all. So let's lower some of the enzymes that are involved in converting that over into, you know, increasing muscle protein synthesis and building muscle protein. Whereas when you go a low protein diet for a while, those enzymes have to ramp up now to take all the amino acids that you've consumed and try to convert those into a complete protein, whether it's muscle protein or whatnot. So it depends on where you are in your diet as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's a lot of caveats and nuances to this stuff, but
and the other thing I like to tell people is we know nothing about muscle growth, but we know we're literally just scratching the surface. Sure. You go in, you do a heavy set, it damages some muscle fibers. Those get replaced with satellite cells and build, or you go in and you stimulate muscle protein synthesis by activating certain genes and that increases protein synthesis. But you increase protein synthesis, then we have something called microRNAs that literally eat it all up. So why would the body waste time making this string of protein, right? And then the body just comes along and goes, nope, we're just going to get rid of that. No, it's, you know, we know so little about those processes and the regulation of muscle growth that we're just scratching the surface. Anybody who tells you this is how a muscle grows is basically lying to you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They don't really know it, unfortunately, but we know so little, literally, about the human body in general, you know?
Yeah, we know what we know now, and the goal really for people listening, this is why it's important to follow people like Jim, to listen to podcasts like this, because you're going to constantly be updated, because that's what our job is, to get updated with new research and continue to give you what we know now so you can continue advancing and learning what's coming, right?
Exactly.
Jim, we're coming up on time, man. This has been great. I'd love to have you back on, because I could probably talk to you about this stuff for...
I'm sure we only got to a percentage of the topics that you wanted to touch base on. So yeah, anytime.
Yeah,
definitely.
I will definitely be getting you back on, because I got a long list of things I could, and I probably could add to it now that I've got a chance to meet you. But I know that you've been putting a lot out on your website, which has a ton of valuable content. Obviously, there's different social media platforms, everything. Can you just tell everybody where to find your supplements, your social, your website, everything you have to offer, so they can go learn more from you?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you can find me on pretty much any social media platform, Instagram, TikTok, X, formerly known as Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Jim Stepani or Dr. Jim Stepani. You can look up there. And then the website, the fitness website, is jimstepani.com. Pretty simple. And that's my fitness website and app. And then the JYM supplement line, you can get it. Walk into any GNC, vitamin shop. You can go to Amazon, or you can go to jimsupps.com, and that's JYMSUPPS.com.
Love it. I'll link all that in the description of this podcast, man. Thank you so much for coming on and spending some time with me.
Oh, thank you for the time. I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, listener, real quick, before you turn off this podcast and move on to your next audio experience, I want to mention two things that I know will be game changers for you, and you could be missing out on them. The first one is our YouTube channel. Head over to YouTube, search for Cody McBroom, and subscribe to my channel. I drop one educational video per week that's between 10 and 20 minutes, and one YouTube short every single day, which means there's 8 more pieces of free content that you could be learning from to be more evidence-based in your approach with training and nutrition and achieving your physique. So once again, head over to YouTube, type in Cody McBroom, and subscribe to the channel, or just click the link in the description of this podcast. The second thing I want to mention is even better. It's our coaching. Because we put out so much free content, you can only imagine what we do for people who actually pay us. And I joke, but I'm dead serious. The value we give is unmatched. We are evidence-based, we are trustworthy, we are loyal to our clients, and we are passionate about what we do. And to be honest, we just get better results than anybody else because we love what we do and we actually know how to do what we do. And in today's world, it can be hard to find a trustworthy and evidence-based coach who not only understands how the body works, but has the credentials to back it up and walks the walk because everybody on my team is actually fit and healthy. So if you want real guidance, real accountability, and real systems that work and provide you with methods that are backed by research and are guaranteed to give you the results that you want as long as you follow our guidance and lead, then head over to tailoredcoachingmethod.com/online-coaching or click the link in the description of this podcast. You can apply for coaching today and get a completely free strategy call, which means you'll talk with me or another coach for 30 minutes straight, completely free and at no risk because you have no commitment yet. If we're a good fit for you and you're a good fit for us, then we'll move forward and we'll get you the best results you have ever seen. All right, go ahead and turn off the podcast. I'll catch you next episode.